The same religion that's capable of hideous acts of destruction can also be capable of moments of healing, of restoration, and of hope.
But educate a girl, and you educate her entire family.
There is a son within every person.
When that anger sets in, write it. Write the letters, but don't send them. You never want to leave concrete proof of insanity.
Thank you all for being here today. My name is Melvin Oliver, and I'm the Dean of the Division of Social Sciences here at UCSB. I want to welcome you all to the opening event to celebrate the naming of the Michael D. Palm Center, formerly known as the Center for the Study of Sexual Minorities in the Military. This naming commemorates $1 million gift from the Michael Palm Foundation to ensure the expansion of the center's data-driven focus to include a variety of emotionally charged topics that frame our public policy discussions and debates. As many of you know, the center has been a prominent force in framing the issue of gays in the military with their Don't Ask, Don't Tell project. The goal of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell project is to improve the quality of information available to public deliberations about military policy. They've done a magnificent job of providing sound research, testifying before Congress, testifying before Congress and blue ribbon panels and commissions, and promoting wide-scale dissemination of their materials. This has resulted in more fact-based discussions on this issue, and a shift in public beliefs about how the policy affects the nation, our armed forces, and the opportunities for gays and lesbians to serve their country. Now, the center's success is directly related to the vision and leadership that Professor Aaron Belkin in our Department of Political Science has brought to this endeavor. Aaron has been a vigorous organizer of national networks of scholars and policymakers, a national spokesperson on the Don't Ask, Don't Tell project, and a great representative to the foundation and individual donor community, gaining significant support for the activities of the center. It was Aaron who brought this work to the attention of the Palm Foundation, and we are pleased today to have Michael Palm's business partner, Stephen Gluckstern, who is also a trustee of the foundation, and his wife, Judy, here today. I'd just like to acknowledge you, Stephen and Judy. Now, we never had the opportunity to meet Michael Palm. He died of AIDS in August 1998. But thanks to his exceptional success as a business person and his philanthropic orientation, we are here today to commemorate his wonderful gift. As Michael believed, and I quote him, "Money has no real value unless you use it to do good things for others," unquote. This gift brings scholarship and reason to bear on those issues that have the most emotional heat surrounding them. It was Michael's strong belief, and I learned this today, in the power of analysis and the revealing power of facts that makes this gift to the center so special. Michael gave much of his wealth supporting causes that were dear to him, and in the Michael Palm Center, we memorialize this gift for social justice, for his fight for social justice and human rights with scholarship in support of action. Let me introduce Professor Aaron Belkin, who will introduce our first inaugural Michael Palm lecture. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Melvin. It's such an honor here today to be among old friends, new friends, students, supporters. But perhaps the biggest honor for me is to be with one of my true heroes and sources of inspiration, Matt Forman. if we think about Dean Oliver's testament to who Michael Palm was, a visionary, an activist, a proponent for social justice, I can't think of anyone more appropriate to kick off the first of what will be an infinite series of annual lectures, Michael Palm lectures, than Matt Forman. 25 years ago, before it was safe to do so, Matt started working for the social justice of gays and lesbians. When September 11th came and people in power wanted to deny partner benefits to the spouses of gay and lesbian victims of that terrible day, it was Matt who stepped forward and made sure that the city passed a law that would ensure that spouses would receive benefits just like everyone else in the straight community. When New York City didn't have a pride parade, it was Matt who stepped forward and organized what has now become an annual ritual where the gay lesbian community comes together to celebrate our identity. As the director of the Empire State Pride Foundation, it was Matt who stepped forward and convinced legislators in Albany to pass the nation's toughest state-level law protecting the rights of lesbians, gays, bisexuals, and transgender people. And now, as the executive director of the National Gay Lesbian Task Force, one of the preeminent gay rights organizations in the entire world, Matt has overseen a doubling of the budget. He's put NGLTF activists in every state in the union. He's hired 50 staff members. He is truly one of the top leaders in the entire country on LGBT rights, and it is such an honor to welcome you to UC Santa Barbara. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I can't tell you what an honor it is to be here today and to help celebrate this wonderful occasion in our movement's history. It's unbelievable that I've been asked to give the first Michael D. Palm lecture. I knew Michael, and he was a wonderful and vibrant man, and I'm so honored to be part of continuing his legacy with you all today. Today, as you know, as we just heard, the Center for the Study of Sexual Minorities in the Military does more than formally change its name. It also formally is enlarging its mission to focus its mission and focus on the use of social science and public policy research to help frame the debate around emotionally charged and socially divisive issues. This could not come at a better time in our nation's history, because we see all the time, even today, how socially charged and divisive issues are used to hurt people and to distort the national discourse. So we are so thrilled that the Michael D. Palm Center will be here to help frame not only the debates around gay and lesbian issues, but it's also taking on other issues. And that's something we know from past experience, that our country, our vision for a better America, cannot advance issue by issue, constituency by constituency, special interest by special interest, but we have to advance on a broad range of issues together. So that's another very exciting thing that's happening today. You know, the center's mission is daunting, not because of the subject matter. And I say that because I don't know anyone who struggles for equality for LGBT people who doesn't yearn for more information and the truth. We really want to know why we are who we are. We really want to know why HIV transmission rates in the African American gay and bisexual communities are at immoral levels. We want to know if it's really true that lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people have higher rates of substance abuse. And if so, why? And what can we do to change that? Are we better or worse parents, or just as lousy as everyone else? What is the real impact, if there's any at all, of granting marriage equality in other countries? We do have some information on these things, but not nearly enough. We are so desperate, we are so hungry for this information that we need more data, more reports, more analyses to confront the lies and the myths of our opponents. And I know that we don't care what that truth is, and we're happy to accept it no matter how painful it may be. But I actually think a greater challenge beyond doing this analysis and issuing these reports and giving us the information we need is how are we going to take this information and make the lives of our people better? I believe that we and the Michael D. Palm Foundation, Center, have so much to learn, I hate to say this, from our opponents in this regard, and that if we do not learn from them, this work, the work of our own policy institute, is destined to be marooned on the shores of good work that goes absolutely nowhere. When I was thinking about the connection between social science research and public policy and the political realities of today, I came across this quote: "When in our history has anyone with ideas so bizarre, so archaic, so self-confounding, so remote from the basic American consensus ever got so far?" I think about that every day. In fact, I think about it every moment. Of course, I'm kind of embarrassed to say that I could not believe that Ronald Reagan was elected president in 1980. I thought the country had lost its mind. And I felt the same thing on 2000, and I felt the same thing even more so in 2004, when I surely thought the American people had had enough. And for those of us working in gay rights and our allies, 2004 was even more painful than 2000 in some respects because of the shameless way that we and our families were used to divide the electorate, to hurt our people, and to pass in 11 states constitutional amendments enshrining our place as second-class citizens for years to come. And those amendments passed by an average margin of 40 points. So I'm sure many of you here can relate to those feelings of hurt and bewilderment and despair. Well, the interesting thing is that the quote that I just read you and that I came across was not from 1980 or 2000 or 2004. Instead, it was spoken by the late historian Richard Hofstadter after Barry Goldwater won the Republican nomination for president in 1964. And yet, the parallels between then and now, to me, are simply astonishing. It was in 1964, after Goldwater's defeat, that I'm never quite sure what the term is, because conservative is too nice, and I actually think that Barry Goldwater was a good and decent man, but the other side decided they were going to get their act together and they were going to conquer America. It was then that they decided to lay the critical foundation about how they were going to conquer America. And look at where we are today. We have a nation, we live in a nation where an entire industry, multi-tens and tens of millions of dollars industry, has been built around demonizing, defaming, and dehumanizing gay people. We live in a nation where the Reverend Pat Robertson and the Dr. James Dobson, not scientists, are allowed to be the leading experts on everything from stem cell research to HIV prevention. And we live in a nation where lying about a blowjob is an impeachable offense, but lying that leads to the literal blowing up of thousands of human people is not. Something wrong with that. And contrary to all the myths they put out there, we now live in a nation with more poverty, more income disparity, a greater proportion of the population living without health insurance, greater segregation in education than we did 30 years ago. So how did we get to this reality so bizarre, so archaic, so self-confounding, and so remote from the basic American consensus? I think one answer to that is the success of our opponents, the people on the right, the conservatives, in that they invested in think tanks and research and institutions, and this has been absolutely critical to their success. And that is why investing in the Michael D. Palm Center is so critical now and in the future. I want to use just one of those think tanks as an example to show you the influence of the right and how they've carefully constructed this mechanism for tearing apart our basic democracy. And I'll use the Heritage Foundation because it was founded in the same year as my organization in 1973. Well, there's a few contrasts right from the start. First 4 years of our organization, our executive director and our office was in his cramped apartment on the Lower East Side, and we paid him in cash under the table. Heritage started out with kind of a sugar daddy, the late Joseph Coors, co-owner of the Coors Brewing Company. Joe's Bucks, I guess people called him Joe, I don't know, I never knew him, were augmented then by financial support from billionaire Richard Mellon Scaife, and their support continues to this day, and I'll talk about that in a minute. With that early infusion of capital, within just 8 years, the Heritage Foundation was exercising enormous influence. In 1980, just 7 years, the entire lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender civil rights movement had less than 30 employees. But the week that Ronald Reagan was elected, the Heritage Foundation handed him its mandate for leadership, a 3,000-page, 20-volume set of policy recommendations, including everything from tax cuts, rollback of the New Deal, increase in military spending. And Reagan's Attorney General Ed Meese said, the Reagan administration will rely heavily on the Heritage Foundation. And it did. It rolled back taxes, New Deal, and Great Society programs. It increased military spending, and on and on. In 1984, Heritage delivered to Ronald Reagan its Mandate for Leadership 2, which recommended privatization of Social Security, the denial of special education for the handicapped, and on and on. And 1 year later, the Heritage Foundation itself said that the Reagan administration had adopted two-thirds of its policy recommendations in those 3,000 pages. And of course, it didn't stop there, that influence. In 2000, Heritage presented George W. Bush priorities for the president. Yeah, I mean, I like they keep coming up with new names. It's good. At this time, they were also thoughtful enough to include as a supplement a budget for America so they could tell the administration how to pay for their recommendations. I mean, I got to give them credit for all this. It's really amazing. And many of us on this side of the political spectrum would now acknowledge, and I think most people in this country who think about this would acknowledge, that the nation's exorbitant deficits, the growing quagmire in Afghanistan, the billions wasted on the missile defense shield, the many failures of NAFTA, the current war in Iraq, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, are inextricably linked to public policy analysis and research that was done by the Heritage Foundation. And closer to my gay home, the research and reports, and I use them in quotes, because when you read them, they're not the kind of research that and reports that are done here. They are, well, they're research and reports, but they're not based in any kind of rigorous academic peer-reviewed study, no. They have been so instrumental in the ongoing attacks against our people. One example is this administration's faith-based initiative, which in addition to rewarding evangelical and right-wing churches for their political support and trying to buy off African-American churches with government money, this program explicitly allows recipients of faith-based initiative money to discriminate against or to override local non-discrimination laws that protect LGBT people from discrimination, laws that we have fought so hard to get. And if you read the administration's official position on allowing this discrimination, it is lifted almost directly from a Heritage Foundation writing. Another example is the fact that the Heritage Foundation had a big thing to do with abstinence-only programs. And they're continuing to vigorously defend them, even though every study has shown not only do they not work, they result in more unsafe sex. And for gay people, saying to our young people, abstinence only, well, that means abstinence only until death because God knows we're not good enough to get married. Here's another example that I know people at the Michael D. Palm Center know so well. Heritage January 1993 executive memorandum entitled, quote, "Exploding Five Myths About the Military's Gay Ban," close quote. This piece of propaganda became the centerpiece of efforts that ultimately that ultimately defeated President Clinton's attempt to open the military to gay people, and were the underpinnings of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which, as you all know so well, continues to afflict us today. I could go on and on and on with these examples, but you get the drift. But how did this happen? I think three things: money, a willingness to couple research with political action, and finally, an unwillingness by people on my side, on our side, the progressive side, who actually believe in science and justice, to see this threat and respond in kind and in scale. On the money front, the data are clear. In 2004, the National Center for Responsive Philanthropy released a report based on analysis of conservative grant-making foundations. Those top foundations have combined assets of over $1 billion. And between 1991 and 2001, which is the most recent data they had granted an average of $46 million a year to conservative think tanks and other organizations on the right that do public policy and public research and policy development. The leading contributor was the very family that helped found the Heritage Foundation, Sarah Scaife. So now, the Heritage Foundation has an annual budget of $36 million a year, and it's been well-funded for more than 30 years. Let's just look at the little slice of the pie of the LGBT world. According to a comprehensive report that just came out a couple of weeks ago that analyzed the top five LGBT foundations, and literally there are only five, so it wasn't like the top five, it was analyzing the five that focus on supporting LGBT rights. These organizations had granted just over $12 million a year to lesbian and gay and bisexual and transgendered organizations of all stripes for all activities, for all social services, not just for research. In other words, the right is dramatically, exponentially outfunding the kind of work that's being done here. Let me just make this really real. All of the think tanks that are focused on LGBT issues combined have fewer than 30 employees. Compare that to the literal armies on the right. Just one organization, Focus on the Family, has over 1,300 employees. The importance of this astronomical difference in resources and history simply cannot be overstated. But second, it was not only money that made this happen. It was also their understanding that research means nothing unless it's put into policy and action. In discussing Heritage earlier, we saw that happening again and again and again. Their research and policy doesn't sit on shelves. They are converted into actual legislation, real rules and regulations. And not only do they develop the model legislation, the rules and regulations, they develop the frame around them, the talking points around them, the language around them, and then they roll them out. And we see this constant revolving door between the think tanks on the right and government, from everything from attorney generals to policy advisors to the president. I mean, the list goes on and on. Moving closer to my gay home again, we saw all of this at work very vividly in the wake of the Foley spectacle and the right's framing of the debate around marriage equality. You know, first Foley, and I want to say, if Foley ever comes and wants his gay card, we're not giving it to him. He doesn't get a toaster. He'll never get a toaster. It's over. But almost immediately, our opponents started spouting the blood libel that gay men, that's been used against us for generations, that gay men are more prone to pedophilia. On October 3rd, Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council was on Hardball, and he said, quote, "There's clear research that shows that homosexual men are more likely to abuse children than straight men," close quote. He based his statement on a Family Research Council study called, quote, "Homosexual and Child Sex Abuse," published in 2002. It was written by Timothy Bailey, who has a PhD in religion, not social science, and it is If you read it, it is bunk. It's just bunk. And even though this blood libel, this assertion, has, or at least we thought, long been discredited, Perkins' statement was not challenged by Chris Matthew. And Pat Buchanan got on a few minutes later, and he too was not challenged. And this same libel was repeated over and over and over again on the chalk shows, everywhere we went. And unlike other times when they put up a gay spokesperson to offer balance, you know, I always think, this is so bizarre. It's like asking Coretta Scott King to offer balance to, you know, a racist and say, you know, I want to give the opposing side. But and an article in the New York Times that repeated this insult chose not to say that it was without basis, only to say that the charge outraged us gay readers. Our Policy Institute promptly responded with a fact sheet detailing every known peer review study on this subject, which shows the absolute opposite of this. For example, a study in the journal Pediatrics reviewed 352 medical records of children evaluated for sex abuse during a 12-month period in Denver and found that only two of those perpetrators were gay or lesbian and concluded, quote, "A child's risk of being molested by his or her relative's heterosexual partner is over 100 times greater than the risk of being molested by someone who might be identified as being gay." But even though we were able, in our own small way, to put that out there, the damage was done. A recent poll conducted by our sister organization, Human Rights Campaign, following the Foley spectacle, found that 30% of Americans believed that the Page scandal came about because gay men are more likely to prey on teenagers and young children. And 23% of Americans said they had a less favorable feeling, they felt more negatively about gay people now than they did before the Foley scandal. This is the consequence of the other side putting out their lies. If you look at the debate around marriage equality, another example, and you go to the Heritage Foundation, you're going to find briefs and fact statements that come right out of Focus on the Family. This is because they're all very much connected and they use each other as the good guys, the attack dogs, etc. But right after we won marriage equality in Massachusetts, right-wing and anti-gay groups purchased full-page ads in the Boston Globe and other major newspapers claiming that same-sex marriage is a threat to children because, quote, "children fare better with a mother and a father." This has been trotted out over and over and over again. Unfortunately, what they were doing was using data on poor outcomes for children raised by single parents and saying that would be the same as children raised by same-sex couples. Unfortunately, obviously that's apples to oranges, but unfortunately we don't have a lot of long-term data about children raised by our families. So even though none of the research available they cited included same-sex couples with children, they created their own truth by repeating it over and over and over again and preying upon myths and stereotypes held by many Americans. And you know what? This truth was repeated verbatim by the President of the United States when he went out in support of the Federal Marriage Amendment. I use these examples because I think they underscore two things. First, as I already said, that our side lacks the fundamental data we need to refute these lies and myths. And second, we lack the infrastructure to take what we have now and what we'll learn in the future and move it quickly into public policy and discourse. In other words, research is critical, but it's not enough. And this brings me to my final point, which is that as the Michael D. Palm Center churns out the reports, the data, and the analysis we so desperately need, I do not think it can divorce itself from the real world in which we live or think that finding and writing the truth is enough. And I know that Aaron agrees with me on this. No, and I'm saying this because it's when I say this to other think tanks, it often comes across like heresy. But this work here must be coupled with how it will be used and amplified. Your research, this research, all of our research must be paired with effective and financed messages so that the real facts come out and they become real truths. This, of course, does not mean in engaging in politics or lobbying or distorting facts or doing advocacy research as the other side does. And I should point out, having talked about the Heritage Foundation so much, they literally do, not legally, but literally do lobby, engage in politics, distort facts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they've never had their tax-exempt status challenged. So, but that's another matter. But it does mean, I think here, having a real willingness and openness to working with people like me, activists on the ground, and thinking about what we need to fight back. It means embracing the reality that your groundbreaking work to be effective and useful will be thrown into the mosh pit of partisan politics, and that you will need to defend and proclaim your work with passion and integrity. It means being proactive with research, not passive, and beyond findings, creating solid, detailed policy recommendations that will change our current realities. It means creating reports and analysis and facts and data that meet the needs of right now, right away, when the next Foley thing happens. It means being nimble, producing facts that are readily digestible and easy to communicate with today's technologies. So I encourage you, I don't have to do this, and I plead with you, and I don't have to do this either, to see activists in our community and in the communities that are fighting for racial and economic justice as your colleagues that desperately need your help and desperately need ammunition to fight. I know you're going to do all this. So in closing, given the might, the wealth, the influence, the extraordinary echo chamber of our opponents, it is beyond amazing how far the movement for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered rights has come in just 35 years. We have, and I don't want to go through the litany of progress, achieved more in a shorter period of time than any social justice movement in the history of the world. With the Michael D. Palm Center joining the fray in a much larger way today, I'm confident now that complete equality for our people is not only possible, but inevitable in our lifetimes. Thank you very much. Now, questions and answers, and I'd like to ask anyone who has one to please come to the mic so that you can be seen by 17 million people across the country.
Hello, my name is David Selberg, and I'm the Executive Director of Pacific Pride Foundation, which is the umbrella organization in our county for gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, and HIV/AIDS programs. And one of the things that's most frustrating in our work occurs when a local columnist, who's also a national columnist, puts articles in the local paper saying that what's key to raising a child is a masculine dad, a feminine mom combination, as you alluded to. And when those columns come out, I get a lot of emails and phone calls to the effect of us not saying anything, my organization not being impassioned to speak to that. And so often what I do is I go to our own program people, Lauren Wyeth, who runs, I'm a little nervous, forgive me. Lauren Wyeth, who runs...
You're out to your mother, right? Okay.
Pardon me?
You're out to your mother, right?
Yeah. Okay, good. My whole family. I am. To make my point, often the most critical voice I hear in my position is from my own community, saying, oh, don't speak up to that. Don't, you know, don't fight that in the media, don't. And that's been a real struggle for me in the position. Oftentimes it's friends of the LGBT community are the most vocal and support our social activist work. So I just wanted to say that.
Thank you. I think what's critical is that we do respond and that we do fight back. And for too long, we have thought that we don't want to give the other side credence by responding, and that to respond just continues the debate. And I think that's been a very bad mistake, because if anything, the Foley scandal has shown us, it's that these myths and stereotypes are still out there, and when they're not refuted, they become even more entrenched. I do think the other thing that we have made a mistake in our community, and the right has not, is figuring out who should be the messengers. And that the best messengers often for us are not people like me who happen to be white, male, middle-aged, and stereotypical, but is to get people, our allies, our parents, our friends, to elevate people of color to respond, so it isn't always the same kind of face that people just tune out. So I think that some of our best allies are those people. And they, frankly, are the most vociferous. Because I think sometimes we grow up being so inured to this that we just let it roll off our backs. Can you come up to the microphone?
Hi.
Hi.
My name is Leia. And may I actually comment on something he said?
Sure.
And then ask a question. I'm actually also a little confused, because in this day and age, who's to say what a good parent is? Or who's to say one parent is better than another? And when they come out with studies saying, well, a mother and a father are better than two mothers or two fathers, who's to say? Because that's kind of in the norm of what they're thinking, the realm of their thinking. But, we don't have any scientific evidence, like you said, proving anything else. So I don't understand how you would go about refuting that, because we also don't have any substantial evidence, to refute that point.
I think what we do say is the data that's available shows that kids are better off if they have two parents. And it's not, there's no studies that show whether two parents the same sex or opposite sex. But a lot of that is about economics, right, and home stability. It's not about the quality of parenting. And in many respects, that kind of stuff denigrates all the real American family, which is composed of so many single parents, right, some people being raised by their grandparents or their cousins or their friends. But I think that's how you refute it. You say that there is no data to show that. And what you're using is this small study, which just kind of goes with common sense. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
Right. Oh, no. And just a question. Forgive me, I don't mean to be impolite. But when you speak of the other side or the conservatives or my opponents, it almost feels like you're giving them more power. Because when they become your opponents, then it's showing that, that you're becoming kind of more hostile. So should we try to bridge the gap between the left and the right and say, well, there really isn't that much difference. We're all trying to live. We're all trying to survive. We're all trying to love one another and be together. I know I'm an idealist, but what can I say? I'm a college student. If I'm not an idealist now, when will I be?
Never.
But do you understand what I'm saying?
I do, but I feel this very strongly, because the stuff I was talking about today, it kind of comes across as like we're talking about research and policy and words and stuff that is removed from real life. And I get to travel around this country a lot and go to places that aren't like Santa Barbara and aren't like Los Angeles and small parts of Los Angeles and small parts of Manhattan. And the consequences of what these people do to our people is appalling. There are 3 times higher rates of suicide among LGBT youth or questioning youth than are among straight youth. 60% of gay and lesbian people, even in this day and age, are not out on the job because they're afraid it will ruin their chances for a promotion or they may get fired, which is still legal, you know, in 33 states. You see, I mean, we just had a young African-American man killed by four black men in New York last week, a hate crime. You know, it was terrible. I mean, I could go on and on, but it's the real consequence in real people's lives. And people think, oh, this is about a gay agenda. You know, it's not about an agenda. At least I don't feel that. And you know what? If other people want to reach out to these people, more power to them. They're wasting their time. We are a fabulous cash cow for them. We are a great issue. I wish I was on the other side. No, I don't wish that, but I think, oh gosh, if I was on the other side, marriage, like, is manna from heaven. You know, it's like, oh God, how can we work? I mean, I don't respect the leadership on the other side. I don't believe that they feel these things sincerely. You know, they want to debate you and then have dinner with you and pretend like it's, you know, and how tolerant they are. Wait, you just condemned our entire people. I don't have any respect for them. And our goal, my goal and the task force's goal in the movement is to be, have this voice. There are other people that can be more reasonable and try to reach the movable middle, which is who we really need to reach. Mm-hmm. But the other side, I'm looking forward to them getting old and dying. So, which is frankly the not painfully. I don't want them to die painfully, just to die.
Hi, my name is Lila Roop. I'm a professor of women's studies here. And I have two questions. One, you've given this really good example of an area in which we need more research. We need research on what happens to the children of gay, lesbian families. So I wonder if you could give some other examples. Like, what do you think are the most critical areas in which we need research that will help us with policymaking? That's one question. The second question is, do you have any ideas where we can get the money to support it? Because obviously that's really critical. If we had big foundations giving us lots of money to do lots of interesting research that had policy implications, I think we'd do a lot better.
Well, I think you can, in terms of research, you can look at almost any factor part of our lives, and we need research on it. We need research on the as we get older, what are our needs? What are the consequences of not having non-discrimination protections or Medicare protections or Social Security survivor benefits? And what can we do short of marriage equality to get those things? We can look at young people in schools beyond the data and the studies we have on violence in the schools, we have a good bit of that. What are the most critical ages that we need to be focusing on to deal with homophobia in the schools? Because I know so many people who grow up, you know, are so wounded by that. When is the critical intervening point so that we could address the other side saying they want to, you know, teach gay things in kindergarten? I mean, it's, you know, I heard that on coming down here. It was James Dobson and Ann Coulter. It was like, oh my God, how did I get on this station? But they were talking. They were. That was going to shock my hand. But you know, they were repeating this, that we want to teach kindergartners about gay sex. But what we do need to know is when are the points to intervene? I mean, I could just go. You could take anything. We need research in so many things, and we need a lot of what we've been doing at our Policy Institute and elsewhere is taking data and stuff that's been done by other people, including the census, and analyzing that and producing reports or summarizing literature. We need more original data. And, you know, where the money is going to come from, I think that some of the things I said today, I think all this stuff is pretty self-evident. There are a lot of rich, progressive people. And they can look at the success on the other side and say, you know, with a modest investment, we can do that. I think it's taking this kind of information and going to people and saying, look, they've been successful. Let's imitate them and do it with truth and integrity. And so many of the progressive dollars have gone into electoral politics, not creating the basis, the framework for a new vision for America. And I think that explains why in this election, I don't know what the Democratic Party's vision for America is or what they would do. I think a lot of Americans are like, I don't know, but they've got to be better than what's there now. But that's not a way to win elections. And that's what the conservatives did starting in 64, is they created a worldview and they framed it. And we haven't done that, and we could.
Hi, my name is Russ Cameron. I'm a MA PhD student in religious studies here at UCSB. And I want to talk about the, being from religious studies, talking about the religious factor within this. And I would agree with you on the one hand on what you said earlier about some of the leaders on the conservative side, and particularly within the religious right, being fairly hypocritical in their beliefs and doing a lot of things for the political advantage rather than actual out of actual belief. But I'd also like to kind of to push back. From that phrase from Professor Belkin, and say that
I went to a Methodist school, and so you knew you were in trouble when anyone would say, "I'm going to say this in Christian love." So go ahead.
So my question is, I think one of the, or my comment is, and then leading into the question, is that I think that one of the scariest things is that a lot of people do sincerely hold their beliefs, which makes it, to me, a very important thing to understand where those are coming from. So my question is, are there any resources for studying the religious aspect of anti-gay sentiment on the right? And if so, what are those networks? And if not, then how might we network to get that started?
Well, I think, you know, all the biblical references to homosexuality, which, you know, other people, it's amazing what things out of the Bible people choose to pick, right, have been exhaustively analyzed backwards and forwards. And I could probably tell you stuff about it that you're not, you know, we all know about. Well, there was no Greek word for homosexuality. And, I mean, fundamentally, you have two opposing views in the religious world. And they're diametrically opposed. I mean, there are people of real faith that are both evangelical and mainline that don't believe that homosexuality is a sin. And there are people in religious world that do. But, you know, I don't know, it's a hard question to answer because, you know, we have a program we merged with an organization this last year that works in welcoming and affirming churches, and we're trying to expand the number of churches that are welcoming and affirming of gay people. And I really respect people that are doing that. And I see people in the Episcopal Church and the Methodist Church, and I see them literally willing to have their organizations splinter over me, which is truly a remarkable thing. You know, at the same time, I hold them up, I think that was the word we used at West Virginia Wesleyan, I hold them up, you know, in great respect and honor. At the same time, you can't escape the reality that what's driving the bigotry against our people is religion. And it's bigotry disguised as deeply held religious beliefs. And that, you know, I can't get around that, and I don't know what to say. I mean, I can say that we have to take the Catholic Church, we should be able to take the Catholic Church at its word and other people at their word, that they do not want to see harm done to us, that they think that discrimination against us is wrong, that it's practicing homosexuality is the sin, not being gay. And I would like to really hold people to that. If you believe that, then we should be protected from discrimination on the job. If you believe that, then we should have a federal hate crimes bill. If you believe that, then there ought to be some protections for our partners when we die. That's where the hypocrisy comes into play. You can't say, you know, I respect gay people. I like, you know, I don't like gay people. I respect gay people. I don't want any harm to come to them. I certainly wouldn't want them to be discriminated against. And then fight against every single piece of legislation or policy that would address some of those issues. But, you know, we're not going to change a lot of people's minds religiously. And it's a shame, though, that those religious beliefs are driving public policy. I don't really care what people believe religiously. They'll have to answer to their God sooner or later. But I do care when they, you know, the way in which religion has come to dominate public policy in our country in the last 30 years.
I'm going to ask a question and also make an announcement in reverse order, if that's okay. The announcement is that as soon as we're done, and this will, I'm going to take the moderator's prerogative of asking the last question. You're welcome to join us. You're invited to join us for a reception out in the hallway. Can I ask one question?
Sure. No.
In love.
I'm hungry now.
Isn't there an opportunity to divorce partisanship from research? One of the students asked you a question before about talking to the moderate middle, and there was some skepticism about that possibility. More specifically, this is what I have in mind. I think about the debate over marriage equality or the debate over military equality. My sense is you can't ever use research to change someone's values. But if you step back and take the research away from the partisanship and simply use the research to ask questions, would allowing marriage equality be bad for children? Would allowing marriage equality increase or decrease divorce rates? Would ending discrimination in the military be good for the military or bad for the military? Those are straightforward social scientific causal questions. And by doing research on those questions and doing it honestly and reporting warts when you find them and reporting good things when you find those things, isn't there an opportunity to build a conventional wisdom around the truth without alienating people who actually might eventually agree with you if you could show them that their positions were not based on fact? In other words, isn't it dangerous to kind of conflate those things? And I'll wait and take my answer so that I can step up and thank you.
Okay. I didn't mean to say that. What I meant to say, and if I did, I didn't. No, I think you're absolutely right. But we need the answers to those questions. And we need to be able to ask those questions and get answers back that people can understand. Like I said, we're not afraid of the truth. We're not afraid of what would come out. We don't care what those warts are. But I also think that just asking those questions, no one starts from a completely objective point of view. And you're asking those questions because we need to know. Why do we need to know? Because we'd like to know if what the other side is saying is right or wrong. And that means we are starting from a point of view. So I think it's outside of, you know, chemical reactions, it's really hard to do social science research that comes with some bias. I do think, you know, on the positive side, the information that we have has changed people's hearts and minds. When we analyzed the census data and looked at African-American same-sex couples and found that among African-American men, gay men, and African-American lesbians, the rate of child-rearing at home was almost equivalent to that of married African-Americans. When we looked at the rate of military service and saw that African-American lesbians were serving in the military many times more than straight African-American women, and we looked at the income disparities between white gay couples and African-American gay couples, and all this data, I think that almost single-handedly reframed the debate around marriage in the African-American gay community, who had seen it as a white construct, as something that was being forced in a, you know, from a privileged point of view. And then when you lay out factually how marriage equality would disproportionately help African-American couples, it made a huge difference. So you're right, facts do really change things. So, okay. Well, thank you all very much.